If you missed last week, we're actually in the second week of a series on the whole work of the church. As I began my pastorate in Seattle, my congregation was recognizing real challenges to sustaining its ministries, and everyone had their own ideas about why and their own strategies for how to correct it. And a lot of the time, the ideas were so conflicted, so different, that there would have been no possible way to pursue everybody's strategy toward revitalizing the church at the same time. The church needed help to revitalize its ministry, and it wisely chose to seek independent counsel, outside help. Now, my clergy colleagues in the area recommended a church revitalization rock star who worked for the United Methodist Church, helping congregations all over the country do just what we were trying to do. Her name was Gail Grossman. And Gail began our first all-church retreat by inviting us to cast our vision wide, to consider the whole of the work of the church, the whole of the life of the church. And then she quickly broke this vision down into four different parts, four processes. For our purposes today, I'll call them four kinds of work. Now, last week, we considered the first work of the church, welcoming. And welcoming includes a wide range of things in the life of the church. Welcoming includes getting on the map, right? Publicity, signage, social media. Do people in the community know where we are? Welcoming means evangelism, reaching out to people personally, making those personal connections. Welcoming can also mean having a social witness, having advocacy, making sure that people in our community know who we are, what we care about, and for whom we care. Welcoming means introducing people to our message and our mission and inviting people to become a part of it. For the different ministry teams in the church, welcoming means different things. For property, it means helping make sure our visitors know where to park, where to enter, find a bathroom, where to meet people, how to attend Sunday school, know where worship is, where's the elevator, right? All of these things go into the work of welcoming. For fellowship, it can mean asking, do these events help new folks to make friends, or are they mostly oriented toward helping the people who are already a part get to know each other better? For worship, it means helping people to know there's a place for them, for their questions, for their concerns, for learning how to be a part of our congregation. This is the first work of the church. It's the work of welcoming. And in the healthiest of congregations, it's a part of the whole life of the church, of each ministry, of each committee. Today, we're considering the second work of the church, connecting. Once a person joins a conversation or engages with our website or Facebook page, or better yet, walks through our door, connecting with them is essential to their decision to stay, to come back, to partner with us in ministry. And as with welcoming, connecting is part of the whole life and the whole work of the church. Pick your ministry team. Connecting is a vital part of its work. How can worship deepen our connection to each other? How can our facility help our relationships deepen and grow? Do we have the kind of meeting spaces that we need for people to build friendships? Fellowship and deacons, those are obvious connections, right? Because those teams explicitly work at caring for each other and helping each of us to care for each other. But how about finance team? Is the work of the finance team a part of the work of connecting us to each other? It may be less obvious, but the way we share and the way we direct our resources, both as individuals and as a congregation, will shape the nature of the connection that we have with others and with those we serve outside these doors. Now, our scripture lesson for today explicitly addresses the work of connecting. It describes why connection is important and the quality and character of the connections that Christians are to discover and to grow. The fourth chapter of Ephesians begins, "I beg you, lead a life worthy of the calling to which you've been called." And the author goes on, "with all humility and gentleness, patience, bearing with one another in love, maintaining the unity of the Spirit," right? All the kinds of behaviors and spirit we see in every church all the time, right? When they go to annual conference, it's what we see, right? All of that patience and love and gentleness. The author says, work at maintaining the unity of the Spirit. And then it offers wisdom about what actually helps us to do that. Because if we're reading this scripture with honest, open eyes, we recognize that Christians are not always the best witness to the unity of the Spirit. So how are we to do this? The author says it's grace. Grace is what we receive as a gift from Christ. But that grace also equips us with all of these gifts from the gift of grace flow, all these other gifts. And that's good because we, the church, are actually a body made of many members. And it benefits us to have many gifts. We are many gifts, but one body. Grace equips the body of Christ with gifts that are for the purpose of building up the body. In fact, the Apostle Paul suggests that's how we recognize something as a spiritual gift. It's something that builds up the body. But then the author goes on. Unity is the sign of maturity. Like children, we can get tossed to and fro and blown about by every wind of doctrine, by people's trickery, by their craftiness and deceitful scheming. But unity is a sign. It's also a responsibility of the believer. It's our responsibility. God gives us the gift through Christ and the gift of grace. We each have been endowed with gifts, but unity is our responsibility, what we are to do with those gifts. They're actually the purpose of the giving of the gifts. In Ephesians 4:15, we read, "But speaking the truth in love, we must grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by every ligament with which it is equipped, as each part is working properly, promotes the body's growth in building itself up in love." Are your bodies all working properly? I'll bet they're not all working properly. If you're like me, from time to time, certain parts of your body scream out for attention or let you know they're not going to work today. Right? But you know, even if you have a part of your body that's not working, you know what it means for that part to work right. And that's what Paul is talking about. A 17th century church father offered a way for us to look at our work, our life, and to prioritize our work toward building unity, toward getting every part to work. Now, maybe you've heard it attributed to St. Augustine or others. As nearly as I can tell, it's this obscure bishop that said, "In essentials, unity. In non-essentials, liberty. And in all things, charity." In other words, when we have a problem in the church, when we have a challenge, when we have a disagreement, there are some who would say, if you're going to be a part of this group, you have to buy it all, right? Lock, stock, and barrel, you got to fall in line. This wise church father said, well, yeah, that's right about the essential things. But the non-essential things, should we have blue carpet, green carpet, red carpet? Most of us would agree, a non-essential question, right? We don't have to have the same opinion on the carpet. That's non-essential, and so we should be at liberty to disagree. Unity in what is essential, liberty in what is not essential, and in all things, charity, love, with love as our guide. So given the deep divisions in our world, our denomination, how do we apply this invitation to deepen and strengthen our connections with each other? That's a question I really want for us to look at today. Now, this week we saw a most dramatic and inspiring way that this played out. I suspect a number of you read the article in the Washington Post about the riptide currents that swept a Florida family away out to sea, and beachgoers who were seeing what was happening worked together to rescue them. Actually, a number went out to try to save them and just increase the numbers who were stranded, but it was forming a human chain. I'm going to read some excerpts from the Washington Post article by Katie Mettler. When Jessica and Derek Simmons first saw the beachgoers pausing to stare toward the water, the young couple just assumed someone had spotted a shark. It was Saturday evening, after all, peak summer season in Panama City Beach, for overheated Florida tourists to cross paths with curious marine life, and they noticed flashing lights by the boardwalk, a police truck on the sand, nearly a dozen bobbing heads about 100 yards beyond the beach, crying desperately for help. It was six members of a single family, four adults and two young boys, and four other swimmers who had been swept away by the powerful and deceptive rip currents churning below the water surface. These people are not drowning today, Jessica Simmons thought. She told the Panama News, City News Herald, it's not happening. We're going to get them out. She was a strong swimmer and fearless in the face of adversity, but others had tried to reach them, and each previous rescue attempt had only stranded more people. There was no lifeguard on duty, and law enforcement on the scene had opted to wait for a rescue boat. People on the beach had no rescue equipment, only boogie boards, surfboards, and their own arms and legs. Form a human chain, they started shouting. Roberta Ursery was among those caught in the treacherous rip currents. From 100 yards away, between crashing waves and gulping salt water, she heard the shouting. By then, Ursery and eight other people stranded with her had already been in the water fighting for nearly 20 minutes. Ursery and the others had ventured into the water to save their two sons, Noah, 11, and Stephen, 8, who had gotten separated from their family while chasing waves on their boogie boards. Tabitha Monroe and her wife Brittany in Panama City for a birthday getaway were the first two to hear the boys' panicked cries for help. The couple had just gone into the water when they saw the boys far from shore. They swam over and grabbed hold of their boogie boards. But when they tried towing them back to shore, the women couldn't break free of the current. They tried to swim straight and they tried to swim sideways. Tabitha Monroe recalled, but nothing worked. After about 10 minutes, a few young men with a surfboard snagged Brittany and towed her back to shore, just as the number of people who needed rescuing grew. Soon, Ursery, who had heard her boys' cries from the beach, was also caught up in the rip currents, followed in close succession by her 27-year-old nephew, her 67-year-old mother, and 31-year-old husband. Another unidentified couple struggled to tread water nearby. The tide knocked every bit of energy out of us, Ursery said. So much water went up Tabitha Monroe's nose that she was sure she would drown, she told the Post. I was exhausted, she said. On shore, the human chain began forming. first with a few, with five volunteers, then 15, then dozens more as the rescue mission grew more desperate. Jessica and Derek Simmons swam past the 80 or so human links, some who couldn't swim, and headed straight for the Urzries, using surf and boogie boards to aid their rescue efforts. "I got to the end, and I know I'm a really good swimmer," Jessica Simmons told the News Herald. "I practically lived in the pool. I knew I could get out there and get to them." She and her husband started with the children, passing Noah and Stephen back along the human chain, which passed them all the way up the beach. By the time Jessica Simmons reached Urzree, the 34-year-old mother could hardly keep her head above the water. "I'm going to die this way," Urzree thought to herself. "My family is going to die this way. I just can't do it." Urzree remembered Simmons coaxing her to carry on. "I blacked out because I couldn't do it anymore," Urzree said. She woke up on the sand to the sound of more screams in the water. Someone yelled that Urzree's mother, Barbara France, still in the water, was having a heart attack. Simmons told the News Herald that France's eyes were rolling back. At one point, the 67-year-old woman told the rescuers to just let her go and save themselves. Instead, Urzree's husband and nephew held France's body up as they struggled to keep their own heads above the water. "And that's when the chain got the biggest," Urzree said. "They linked wrists and legs and arms, and if they were there, they were helping." Nearly an hour after they first started struggling, just as the sun prepared to set, all 10 of the stranded swimmers were safely back on the shore. The entire beach began to applaud. "It was beachgoers and the grace of God's will," Urzree said. "That's why we're here today." Both Brittany Monroe and France were transported to a hospital. Monroe was later released after being treated for a panic attack, and France remains hospitalized, her daughter said. She suffered a massive heart attack and an aortic aneurysm in her stomach, but has been taken off the ventilator and is considered to be in stable condition. The Urzree's plan to meet up with Jessica and Derek Simmons once France is released from the hospital. But Roberta said she could give hugs to the dozens of strangers who rescued her family. "It actually showed me there are good people in this world," she told the Post. In a Facebook post, rescuer Jessica Simmons expressed the similar sentiment. "To see people from different races and genders come into action to help total strangers is absolutely amazing to see. People who didn't even know each other went hand in hand in a line into the water to try and reach them. Pause and just imagine that." Did you read that article or see any of that on the news? I know it got some pretty good coverage because it was so inspiring and so much needed at a time when we're so broken and disconnected from each other. Friends, this is not a club. We're here to save lives. We're here to help broken people be whole. We're here to help our whole world be whole. We can call it salvation, healing, transformation. It's why Jesus lived and died and rose again and dwells in the living Christ wherever Jesus' work continues. This is why we as a church exist. But it's not just why we're here, it's who we are. This purpose shapes our life and our work. It's why we welcome all people, and it's why a welcome is not enough. Salvation, healing, transformation require relationship, that we be connected to each other. In the church, the true source of our connection is not our ethnicity, it's not our socioeconomic status, it's not our nationality, it's sure not our doctrinal uniformity. It's not that we agree on everything. It's not our political affiliation. We're connected by our knowledge that we're all children of God, that we're all part of Christ's body, that we're members of one another. And so we encourage each other to build up the body, to imitate God, to live in love as Christ loved us. And I'd like to take just a few moments, if we could, to pose some questions for you to respond to. Not hypotheticals. I mean, to have a conversation. And I'll just name the questions, and then we can take them one at a time. In your life, when have you experienced the deepest connection with others? What ingredients made it possible? What might you change in your life to deepen connections with others right now? What might we change in the life of our congregation or the wider church or this community to deepen our connections with each other? Let's go back to the first. In your life, when have you experienced the deepest connection with others?
College is an easy time to do that because you're living alongside other people and often in an environment where you're all kind of there thrown together. But in particular, I studied abroad for a semester in Ireland with a group of mostly psychology majors. And it was a very intentional community that of Christians who desired to understand each other and support each other. We had regular meeting times where we kind of addressed questions that required vulnerability and compassion toward one another. And those people, that group of 30 people from Taylor, we're still in touch today. We celebrate each other's life milestones and all of that.
Who else? Perfect.
When so many of my family has passed away, I had great, great help from neighbors and whoever knew me. So I'm thankful for that.
So going through your life passages. Yeah.
Yeah. Shana, I've got this headset. Okay.
When you have a common goal, when everybody's working for the same thing, just like in the story, because it made me think about times when I've been out in emergency management situations, and it's different than a normal day of work where people may be there for different reasons. But when you're on a site, you can feel it. Everybody's pulling the same. You just know.
Yeah, you got the same purpose. Yeah. Right. Right. Any other thoughts on when you have felt the strongest connection with others? What have been those ingredients? Carolyn.
Back during the Clinton years of the White House, I answered the comment line.
Oh, really?
And one day a lady called saying that she took care of 3 or 4 people who were on life support. And she was not able to pay her electric bill, and they were going to turn off her electricity in 24 hours.
Wow.
And so I was able to put her in contact with the correct people. Right now, I don't remember exactly who it was, but there was a number that I had. And she was able to get some help and pay her bill and put off the turning off of the electricity.
Wow.
I'll add to that question, where have you felt when you've had the deepest connection with others in the church, in the denomination, in our community outside the church? What have been the ingredients that made that connection possible? Service? Yeah.
When I think back to those experiences, I think about time and I think about vulnerability. So carving out the time to spend with people that's not hurried, to really get to know each other, and then having the kindness and the grace with each other that people feel comfortable sharing who they really are and are able to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm.
Well, it might be asking too much for you to share what you could do in your life right now, personally, to deepen your connection with others. I want you to feel free to do so, or if you want to name your own need in that way for the rest of our body, so that we can know and understand and lift you up, feel free. But if you also have insight into how we might deepen those connections or facilitate those connections in this congregation, in the wider church, in our community, what would you offer? What could we do right now that would help to deepen and strengthen our connections? Missy.
The times I've felt most connected at this church are always the times that I've been struggling in my life. So I know that if you ask at this church, it's always there, whether it was when Piper was in the hospital or when my parents have been sick or any kind of time that there was something going on. But I think that there's something that stands between people and the ability to ask. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is something we could do to help with developing that ability to be vulnerable, like what Kate said, is that it's for people who are comfortable being vulnerable, the help is there, but it's really hard for a group that meets once a week to know what people's needs are. Mm-hmm. So there's something to that small group that helps us to get to know each other and have that comfort. Mm-hmm. So I really think that working on building vulnerability, mm-hmm. building a comfort with each other, mm-hmm. that there's always room for improvement in that area, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks. Friends, this is not a club. This is a body. We welcome people into its membership. That's the first work of the church. And we deepen our connection to each other. This is the second work of the church. Thanks be to God.